In this weekend's episode, three segments from the past week's Washington Journal. First, the Supreme Court heard oral argument this week on whether former President Trump can be prosecuted over his alleged efforts to undo the 2020 election results. We talked to two legal experts about the case and its implications, Elizabeth Wydra of the Constitutional Accountability Center and Hans von Spakowski of the Heritage Foundation. Then, we turn our attention to a recent report on chronic absenteeism in America's schools. We speak with Nat Malkus of the American Enterprise Institute about his research and recent trends. Plus, a conversation with Oswald Thomas, a victim of gun violence, longtime organizer, and vice president of the group Alliance for Safety and Justice. We'll talk about his group's efforts to expand resources for victims of violent crime.
Hello, I'm Pam, and joining me today is Zach as we celebrate 45 years of C-SPAN's unblinking eye on the democratic process.
That's right, Pam. Since our founding in 1979, C-SPAN has been documenting history with a unique approach, unfiltered, without commentary, and entirely independent from government funding. C-SPAN is funded by fees from our cable and satellite distribution partners, and now, with fewer people subscribing to cable and satellite, we're asking you to help support our next 45 years.
It's amazing to see how C-SPAN has adapted and grown. With the rise of digital platforms and social media, C-SPAN has expanded its reach so that no matter where you are, you have 24/7, 365 access to the democratic process.
As we navigate this ever-changing media environment, C-SPAN's dedication to putting you in the rooms where politics is debated and policy is determined will not waver.
We ask you to support C-SPAN's vital mission. As we celebrate 45 years of service, your contribution helps us to continue to adapt and grow in this digital age. Visit cspan.org/donate to make your contribution today.
So, here's to 45 more years of bringing democracy directly to you wherever you get your news. Thank you for your support. Visit cspan.org/donate today to make a difference.
But we begin with that big Supreme Court case this week on former President Trump's immunity claim and our conversation with Elizabeth Wydra of the Constitutional Accountability Center and Hans von Spakowski of the Heritage Foundation, who started the discussion.
Look, folks really need to divorce themselves from whether they like Donald Trump or hate Donald Trump, because what this case is about is the ability of all presidents, now and in the future, to be able to carry out their duties without fear of potential criminal prosecution when they leave office by potentially a hostile administration coming in who doesn't like what they did. And what the Trump team is arguing is that the president has immunity for his actions as president, and that the precursor, that doesn't mean that a president can never be prosecuted. What their brief says is that the precursor to this is laid out in the impeachment clause. If you look at the impeachment clause, obviously it's Congress that has the power to remove a president who engages in misbehavior, you know, high crimes and misdemeanors. And if you look at the language of the impeachment clause, it specifically says that a person convicted can be indicted and tried and basically punished criminally. But the precursor to the federal government prosecuting a former president is that first Congress had to have acted to impeach him. And if the Congress didn't impeach him, then he can't be prosecuted. And that's basically the argument. The Justice Department is opposing all of that and saying there's no immunity for a president once he leaves office.
You mentioned Donald Trump's legal team's brief. Elizabeth Wydra, you joined an amicus brief, one of those friends of the court briefings, on this case. So if the justices happen to give you 3 minutes today to make an argument before the bench, what would you say?
Yes, thank you so much. So my colleagues and I at the Constitutional Accountability Center filed a brief on behalf of a diverse, ideologically diverse group of constitutional scholars that really come from the very beginning principle of this country that no one is above the law and the president is not a king. That was really an innovative step for our new country to take. And one of the key things about the president not being a king is that he is subject to the law like anyone else. This was one of the key principles at the time of the drafting of the Constitution and one of the key selling points to the American people for why they should support the Constitution. And in fact, at the North Carolina Ratifying Convention, James Iredell, who was one of our nation's inaugural Supreme Court justices, explicitly said that the president, if he commits a crime, will be subject to the laws of the country and prosecution. So that has been a principle, an essential principle to American democracy and our constitutional structure since the very beginning of this country. And the impeachment clause, I strongly disagree, and not just me, but conservative and liberal constitutional scholars from across the spectrum, I disagree with Hans's description of the impeachment clause. The impeachment clause makes clear that it is a separate process from criminal prosecution. The impeachment process has always been understood to be a political process. And the impeachment clause makes clear in the American Constitution that the punishments for impeachment, unlike in Britain, the punishments here would be removal from office and disqualification from holding future office. In Britain, in contrast, if someone was impeached, they could even be like drawn and quartered. So it's making clear that those are the consequences for the political process of impeachment, but it in no way requires impeachment before criminal prosecution. Those have always been understood to be separate processes with separate safeguards. And also they serve separate purposes. Criminal prosecutions are there to punish and deter criminal behavior. And impeachment is a political decision, which, has its pros and its cons. And also, I would just point out that, you know, the arguments that Trump is making this time are very different from the arguments that his legal team made during the impeachment process. In fact, they emphasized that Trump would not be above the law because he could be subject to criminal prosecution. And so that was an argument for why they should acquit him in the political impeachment proceedings. So that's a different argument being made now, but that's okay. People can change their arguments. And then finally, I would just add that, you know, I think that this case is one where I think it's likely that the Supreme Court, because of the overwhelming weight of text and history against President Trump's sweeping absolute and permanent immunity arguments, I think it's very likely that the Supreme Court will rule against him. One thing that I would ask the viewers to think about is looking at the timing of that decision. The Supreme Court certainly could issue its ruling quickly. The Supreme Court has done that on important cases that implicate fundamental issues of American democracy. And so I think that the Supreme Court should issue its ruling, not just correctly, ruling against Trump's sweeping claim, but also quickly so we can have justice proceed.
I want to get to the political implications of the timing of this ruling, but just staying on the arguments for a second right here, Hans von Spakovsky, the idea that no one is above the law in this country. Is the president above the law in this country? And if not, why do we have the immunity, the power of immunity?
Yeah, but with all due respect to Elizabeth, that's a misleading claim. No one is saying the president is above the law. But what the Constitution lays out is if the president, and look, she's correct that impeachment is a political process. You don't have to have committed a crime to be impeached. But the impeachment provision is there so that if a president engages in such misbehavior that he should be removed, or if he commits a crime, he can be removed by Congress. He's not above the law because, as I said, the impeachment clause says that if the president is impeached and if he is convicted by the Senate, then once he's convicted he can and removed from office, he is subject to criminal prosecution. But for the very same reason that in 1982, the Supreme Court in a case called Fitzgerald held that presidents are immune from civil liability because they would be unable to function. If a president knew that he could be personally sued civilly for actions that he took as president, it would completely hamper a president from being able to carry out his duties, and the fear of criminal prosecution would do the same thing. I'll give you just one quick example, if I may. You'll recall that during the Obama administration, he ordered a drone strike on individuals that he had labeled as terrorists, and the result was that U.S. citizens were killed. That raised a great deal of criticism. If a president did not have immunity for such actions from criminal prosecution than when the next administration came in that was hostile to him, in this case, the Trump administration. They could have initiated a prosecution against the president for that drone strike under a very specific federal statute. It's 18 U.S.C. 956, which makes it a crime to, in this country, conspire to kill, injure, maim a person in another country. Without immunity, Obama could have been prosecuted. I don't think he should be. But that's an example of how this question applies to all presidents. It doesn't matter which political party they're in.
Let me stay on Nixon v. Fitzgerald for a second.
Sure.
1982,
right.
Supreme Court rules that former President Richard Nixon could not be sued by an Air Force analyst who said that he was fired in 1970 in
right.
retaliation for his criticism of cost overruns. Elizabeth Wydra, how do you read that case, and why should it be different, the results of that case, than this case?
Yeah, I'm so glad that that was raised early, because it's really an important precedent that goes against Donald Trump. You know, as Hans laid it out, he specifically said it applies to civil actions. And that is extremely important, because the case in the Nixon Fitzgerald case, was very clear that this was talking about immunity from civil actions. And there are key differences between the civil litigation process and the criminal prosecution process that makes immunity inappropriate for the criminal processes. A few of those are that when it comes to criminal prosecutions, there are multiple layered safeguards that protect against frivolous cases being brought. Constitutional safeguards. There has to be an investigation by a governmental body. There has to be a grand jury indictment. The grand jury was seen as a bulwark of liberty and protection in the founding era under the Constitution. So that grand jury procedural safeguard is incredibly important. All of the burdens of proof that are required for a criminal prosecution, as opposed to the lower burdens of proof in civil actions. The importance of this criminal context could not be overstated, because in civil actions, you know, you could imagine that thousands of people could maybe bring a civil action, and the barriers to access to court for those civil actions are lower than in a criminal prosecution. So there are already built-in procedural protections against a flood of litigation that would come toward a president for committing a crime. Secondly, as that statement just suggests, the public's interest in having a prosecution for a criminal act by the president is much greater than having civil actions be allowed to go forward against a president. And so that's something that also is a key distinction. So I think that the Supreme Court, frankly, is going to take this Fitzgerald precedent as something that weighs against Donald Trump's immunity claims in this particular case.
That was Elizabeth Wydra of the Constitutional Accountability Center and Hans von Spakovsky of the Heritage Foundation. Next, we take a deep dive into a recent report into chronic absenteeism among American school kids and why it persists since the COVID-19 pandemic. We spoke to the author of that report, Nat Malkus, of the American Enterprise Institute.
Can you tell us a little bit about your own background as an educator and an analyst that led you to start looking into this?
I was a public school teacher here in Maryland, and then went from there to pursue an education policy background, and have been at the American Enterprise Institute studying sort of data on schools. I crunch a lot of numbers. And when the pandemic started, we began tracking schools' responses to the pandemic. In the first year, we tracked sort of the closures, and the second year, sort of masking and some other things. But the thing that we've been focused on for the past year is chronic absenteeism, which is a measure of the percentage of students who are missing at least 10% of the school year. And over the pandemic, this has really surged. And in my mind, it's the number one problem that schools are facing today.
And for folks who aren't familiar with the American Enterprise Institute, can you describe a little bit about the organization, your funding, and political affiliations or leanings?
Yeah, AEI, as we're usually known, the American Enterprise Institute, is a right-of-center but nonpartisan public policy think tank. We have lots of different scholars, and scholars work independently. So when I represent views here, they're mine, not AEI's. I work in the education department, the domestic policy center.
And your funding?
Our funding, we're independently funded, no government money whatsoever, and we have independent supporters from sort of across the nation.
You write that, quote, having cataloged how the nation's schools responded to the pandemic for the past 4 years, I see two main challenges facing schools today. The first is learning loss, which at its height in 2022 saw students more than half a year behind in math and more than a third of a year behind in reading. The second is less well-known but arguably more important, absenteeism. So you wrote a report on this, long COVID for public schools, chronic absenteeism before and after the pandemic. Can you give a bit more detail about what you found?
Yeah, so again, chronic absenteeism is the percentage of kids missing a tenth of the school year. Pre-pandemic, this was a problem. Mm-hmm. This is not a new problem, but it affected about 15% of students in the nation. This is K through 12, so this isn't just high schoolers. Neither is this truancy. This is just the absolute number of absences students have. And the reason this is important is because if you miss a lot of school, it's not good for students, whether it's for truancy or extended sickness. Over the pandemic, that jumped to about 28%. So it went up a huge amount, and it's been stubbornly high. So it's come down a bit in the last school year we have data. But only to 26%, so still more than one in four students. And you asked about, why is this such a big problem? Well, the learning loss problem is a large problem, and we've also seen some progress on that. But fixing this huge learning loss problem is going to be very difficult at these levels of absenteeism. If you have this many kids absent, how are they going to learn faster than they did before the pandemic to catch up to where we hope they would be? So that's why it's such a pronounced problem.
Let's dig a little bit deeper into some of the data points that you raised just now and that are also in your report. Nationwide, chronic absenteeism, the percentage of students missing at least 10% of a school year, jumped from 15% in 2018 to 28% in 2022. It's falling in 33 of the 39 states reporting data. The rates remain improved in 2023, but still remained 75% higher than that pre-pandemic baseline. Chronic absenteeism increased for all district types, but rates were highest in districts with low achievement and higher poverty, affecting over one in three students. And then in 2022, you found that 16% of Asian students and 24% of white students were chronically absent, compared to 36% of Hispanic students and 39% of black students. Can you break down some of those areas where we're seeing improvement and areas where not so much?
Yeah, so the improvement and the surge are incredibly even. Mm. Now, there's two things that you have to understand at the same time to really understand these changes. One is pre-pandemic, disadvantaged students had higher chronic absenteeism. So mm-hmm. if you were lower achieving compared to higher achieving students, you just tended to have higher rates of absenteeism. That's also true after the pandemic, but the increase was about the same. So everybody is about 90% higher than mm. they were before the pandemic. Now a little bit lower, but not getting low fast enough. And so the important thing to understand here is that the change that we've seen is really evident across the board. It's in red and blue states, high and low achieving school districts, urban, rural. It's more broad than almost any other factor I've seen in my years as an analyst.
Let's get into some of the reasons that kids are missing school. The Associated Press reports that kids are staying home for a myriad of reasons: finances, housing instability, illness, transportation issues, school staffing shortages, anxiety, depression, bullying, and generally feeling unwelcome at school. And the effects of online learning linger. School relationships have frayed, and after months at home, many parents and students don't see the point of regular attendance. Does that line up with what you found?
So it does. And again, I don't have perfect insight. I can tell you the data from 20,000 feet, but understanding why millions of kids aren't showing up to school as regularly as they once did, is something that I have to sort of extrapolate from. I do think that all these factors contribute to chronic absenteeism. But the key question that I keep asking myself is, but what changed over the pandemic? Why over the pandemic did these things increase? Is it transportation problems that got 90% worse over 2 years? I think that that certainly points to a question about what did the pandemic itself do to the habits, the norms, the behaviors that once made it sort of routine to go to school for the vast majority of students. And now those habits or the culture of attendance seems to be more permissive for all those reasons that you mentioned sort of on the front end.
The Washington Post kind of asked the same question about what happened during the pandemic. And Paul Kim, Washington, D.C.'s deputy mayor for education, said the pandemic did something to change students' and families' relationships with schools to some degree that we don't yet fully understand. We also come to understand that there are a not insignificant number of families that actually don't think it's crucial to have their kid in school every day. I mean, you did mention that you're looking at this sort of from 20,000 feet, but, you know, as a former educator and someone just out there in the world, what are you hearing from families?
Well, actually, I'm hearing just that. I talk a lot about this, about, well, it seems like there's a change in culture, and I hear it frequently. Mm-hmm. I hear it from folks who will tell me, well, I see this as a problem. Chronic absenteeism is a problem. Actually, my kid's probably chronic absent, but it's okay for my kid. That's the sort of rationale that has actually changed. That's the culture change. Mm-hmm. When you hear it from a lot of people that's saying, well, it's a problem for other people, and I see it in my own family or among my own friends, but it's not as big of a deal. If what we're seeing is broad-based sort of agreement or discussion about absenteeism, as if maybe it's not as important anymore, we should expect this to continue. And that is exactly where I think we need to push back. We need sort of governors, we need state officials, and everyone from principals and teachers down to parents to turn this around and really change our thinking. Because I'll tell you, kids who are chronically absent are less likely to be able to read and do math in third grade. They're less likely to succeed academically in middle school. They're less likely to graduate high school. They're less likely to have as much success in college and career afterwards. So this is not risk-free. This is a very risky number that we're talking about.
That was Nat Malkus, Deputy Director of AEI's Education Policy Studies Program. Finally, a different take on criminal justice reform, this one focusing on the victims of violent crime and efforts to expand public resources to help them recover.
Aswad Thomas is at our table this morning. He's the vice president of the Alliance for Safety and Justice, the national director of the Crime Survivors for Safety and Justice as well. We want to talk about resources for survivors of crime. This is personal for you. Tell us your story.
I just thank you so much for having me on today. You know, back in 2009, I had just became the first male in my family to ever graduate from college. I was also a star college basketball player on my way to play professional overseas. But unfortunately, I became a victim of gun violence in Hartford, Connecticut. I was shot twice in my back, and those bullets ended my professional basketball career and nearly my life. And like so many victims, I was released from the hospital back into the same community where the incident happened with no support, no services, no resources to recover from that incident, which changed my life like crime does to so many victims of crime.
What were you doing at the time of this, and what were you doing in that community at that time?
Yeah, I was just leaving a corner store in my neighborhood where I became a victim of an armed robbery. As a result of that armed robbery, I was shot twice in my back just weeks before I was supposed to go overseas to play professional basketball. And that incident, my doctors told me about the physical challenges that I would have, but nobody never mentioned the psychological effects of being a victim, dealing with the PTSD, the anxiety, the stress, the nightmares of that incident. But like so many victims, law enforcement came to visit me several times during that recovery process. But each time that they visited me, it was always about the case. They never asked me how I was doing. They never told me about any victim services that my family could seek out and get support. In fact, they never even told me about a victim advocate in their department that's supposed to work with victims like myself. So my family and I were left to deal with that incident on our own. And that started me, you know, this new journey of working with crime victims across the country.
What resources were you looking for at the time?
Yeah, like many crime victims, access to things like mental health. You know, I was shot, you know, just blocks away from where I lived at. I would have loved to be able to get housing relocation support to help me move away from that neighborhood that traumatized myself and my family as well. In addition to that, every state have a victim compensation program that pays for expenses like mental health counseling that helps with the housing relocation support, but I was never made aware of none of those services, which is the experience of thousands of crime victims across the country of not getting support. Even the person that shot me was also a victim of gun violence 4 years before I got shot, and the doctor that saved my life saved his life as well. But just like me, he was released from that same hospital back into that same community with no support, and I strongly feel like his unaddressed trauma played a huge role in my shooting years later.
What evidence do you have that these resources are needed, and on what scale?
Yeah, you know, I travel the country meeting with crime victims, families who've lost loved ones to violence, meeting with victims of domestic violence and sexual assault, victims of crime across the country, especially in communities that are most harmed by violence. Those communities and those individuals are least supported by the justice system, are least supported by victim services. So there isn't an infrastructure of counseling and therapy in communities. So many organizations that are doing incredible work helping victims navigate the justice system, helping to provide grief counseling support. So many of those organizations don't have the resources that's needed to help support crime victims. So our organization works to organize and train those survivors and organizations to be advocates to invest in more resources.
Why don't they have the resources?
For several reasons. You know, when I look at crime and violence in this country, especially in communities of color that are most impacted by violence, we have been disrespected and disregarded for decades. The way that crime policy has been designed in this country, it doesn't protect the people who are most harmed by violence, and the resources that have been coming into communities for decades don't actually go to people that need it the most. So there are racial disparities that exist in the criminal justice system, but also there are racial disparities that also exist in victim service and who actually gets help or not.
Why aren't they getting the resources?
Why aren't they getting the resources? So many policy barriers that exist. For example, the victim compensation program. Every state have a victim compensation program to help pay for things like funeral and burial expenses, to help the cover of counseling, to help with the housing relocation that I mentioned, to help change the door locks. Every state have that type of program for crime victims, and is known as the payer of last resort. So if you don't have insurance, if you don't have any resources to cover a funeral for your loved one who lost their lives to violence, there's a program that exists to help people. But the challenge with that is that we did a survey of thousands of crime victims across the country, and over 96% of victims did not access the victim compensation program. So most people don't know about it, a lot of people don't access it, but also there are significant policy barriers that exist as well. Just to give you an example, in order to be eligible for the victim compensation program, in some states you have to file a police report within 48 hours or 72 hours after becoming a victim of a crime. If you meet that threshold, in some states you only have a year or two to apply for the program. Those are barriers that exist in policies. If you or a loved one is on probation or parole, if you owe fines or fees, you're not eligible to access the victim compensation program. And there are also the policy barriers where law enforcement deemed that you've contributed to your own victimization, so you're not able to get access to compensation. So those are some of the barriers that exist. Most people don't know about it. people that do know about, especially crime victims in communities of color, most people will not be able to access the program because of those policy barriers.
And in your case, you were in the hospital for, if there was a 48-hour policy in your case, you were in the hospital for how long?
I was in the hospital for a week. And I didn't know about the victim compensation program until 10 years after I became a victim of a violent crime when I joined my organization. But I come from a family of victims. My father was shot in his chest in the 1980s. My second oldest brother was shot in the 90s. I have two cousins that were also victims of gun violence. And we all had plenty of interactions with the justice system, plenty of interaction with a hospital, but none that actually led to any help or services for us to deal with those experiences of being victims.
That was Oswald Thomas, vice president of the group Alliance for Safety and Justice. Hear more interviews from C-SPAN's Washington Journal on our website at cspan.org, on the C-SPAN Now app, or on C-SPAN Television, live every morning from 7 to 10 a.m. Eastern Time.